KaiserNetwork.org.
Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome to the stage the President of America Speaks, Carolyn Lukensmeyer.
Thank you. Please go ahead and take time to find your seats, and please fill in these tables in the front. You're going to want to engage with these panelists as much as you can. America Speaks is truly honored to be working with the Clinton Global Initiative for its second annual meeting. I just want to make a quick check. Hands up high if you were here last year. So it looks like about two-thirds of us were here last year, and about a third of us in the energy and climate change are new folks. I'm going to take just a minute to talk about some things that are a bit unique about this conference. But before I do, I want to mention over lunch, Thomas Gaston said a quote that I thought, or said something I thought was definitely quotable. This year, there has probably been the largest change in a public policy issue from the status of understanding about energy and climate change in 1 year's time that we may ever have seen. And what Thomas said was, you know, the headwinds are abating, but we don't have a tailwind behind us yet. So the headwinds may have reduced, but part of what we hope today is to get that energy in and get as many action commitments from every single one of you in this room as we possibly can to take advantage of the shift that's happened in public awareness, advantage of the shift that's happened in willingness to invest in green energy sources and building. So it's really a significant time for this meeting to occur again. Because we have some new folks, I'm going to take just a couple minutes to explain how we work. In a few moments, our first esteemed panel will be up here on the stage. They'll have about a half an hour of discussion. You all have cards at your tables, and at any point during the discussion that an important question occurs to you that you'd like the panel to address, you just jot that question on the card and hand it to your table facilitator, who is also doing recording of notes into the computers. What we'll be able to do is, rather than just hearing one or two questions, because of the computers and the work of the theme team in the back of the room, we'll be able to pull together collectively what were the four or five questions that most of you wanted to hear responded to. And then the moderator and panel will have an opportunity to look at those and respond. After they finish their first half hour, you'll have a full half hour for discussion at your tables. What we know is that every single person in this room has some significant ideas about this topic that should not be lost. Part of what Clinton hopes here is it isn't that just people will learn from the experts who've been asked to be on the stage, but people will be learning from the experts who are at all the tables. The facilitators and the theme team are going to work really hard today because this is going to be pretty fast-paced and they have a very short turnaround. I'd like them all to stand up and give them a round of applause before we even get started. Okay, two last comments. This one, in the movie screens, they have a great screen and you get jerked out of your seat. But all of you who have cell phones or pagers, please, now, turn them off or put them on vibrate. We don't want that kind of interruption. Second thing, every single person in here is passionate about this issue. That often leads in the table discussions to taking a little more time from your idea than there's really time for. There's eight or nine of you at every table. The facilitator is going to help with that. But please just make your points fairly on target. Don't take up too much time, as we really want to get as far as we can go. I want to follow David's lead and say, fundamentally, we need two things. Have a great time and deepen your commitment by selecting some additional action steps that you can do personally on this issue of energy and climate change, as well as what you commit your organization to. Thank you very much.
Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome our panelists for Energy Saving Companies. CEO, Swiss Reinsurance Company, Dr. Jacques Agrin. Vice President and Chief Sustainability Officer, DuPont, Linda Fisher. Chairman and CEO, Primary Energy Ventures, Thomas R. Kasten. Former Supreme Allied Commander of NATO, General Wesley Clark. And your moderator, founding partner, Aqua International Partners, William K. Riley.
Well, good afternoon, and welcome to all of you to this panel. I think this is a hopeful panel, and I agree with the comment that was attributed to Tom with respect to the progress that we've made this year, both in significant commitments to address the climate issue, particularly in California, and also to the greater public awareness, stimulated more than anything else, I think, by an inconvenient truth. So we now have the anomaly of a movie star turned politician and a politician turned movie star, and it really suggests the kind of transformation the country could anticipate. I think for those of us who have been involved with this issue for some time, the most difficult to understand reality is that irrespective of the very compelling science that we have seen with regard to climate change, we have not seen a concomitant public response or sense of urgency. And I think one reason for that, a number of private conversations, particularly in Washington, reinforce this, is a sense that, yes, we believe in the science, so many people will say, but we just aren't sure the economy is up to addressing this issue. We're not sure we want to bet the economy on it. Well, the panelists that you're going to hear from here essentially have made commitments or significant achievements in reducing their energy use and improving their energy efficiency, and in the process, reducing greenhouse gases. In fact, industry has done pretty well on this issue. While the United States has increased by about 42-43% its energy use in the last 30 years or so, a little more, we have seen industry increase its energy use by 10%. And some of the ways that has been accomplished are going to be suggested by what we're about to hear. So we're going to start off with Mr. Ecrin. A number of us are familiar with the very visible and aggressive energy commitments that Swiss Re has encouraged by its very public regard for the need to address climate change. I guess my first question is, why does energy efficiency matter so much to Swiss Re? You don't manufacture products, you don't have large vehicle fleets. But what is it about the issue that has brought you to make such a salient commitment to it?
Thank you. I would like to first start by correcting a statement which was made a little bit earlier about the fact that this panel is a panel of experts. My colleagues on the panel are certainly experts. I'm just an interested citizen, and my shareholders are very interested by the issue. So there is a natural stakeholder interest in the issue, as the insurance and the reinsurance world are eventually most directly exposed to the consequences of climate change. So it's a broad macroeconomic consequences. I think that one extraordinary gentleman in this room, which has business in the same field, and our business are basically together paying approximately 10% of any climate events which takes place in various places in the world. So that's why we thought at Swiss Re that if we are concerned about the consequences, we also, even if we have very modest emission consequences in our own business, put our own house in order. And there is a question of communication, there is a question of making sure that all of our employees and the entirety of our community is committed and understands why we care.
Do you make business decisions differently than you might otherwise?
I think that by definition, we have to take risks which are related to the climate consequences. And obviously, we are continually adjusting based upon scientific evidence. Unfortunately, as you must know, the scientific evidence has forced us to continually increase the cost of insurance. So the overall economy is paying the price.
And you believe that's already happened? Is there a consequence of storm and flood damages?
I think that there is hardly any doubt that we have a long-term trend what is the exact impact of human activities versus other type of causes is a matter for interesting debates that I will pass aside. But there is absolutely no doubt that we have a long-term trend which related in particular to the sea surface temperature is leading to a more active windstorm activities in every part of the world. There is a tendency to focus particularly in the U.S., but actually the typhoon activity in Asia and the wet windstorms, which translates in floods in Europe, have increased in a very visible fashion.
Linda, with respect to DuPont, I think the very large reductions in energy use, improvements in energy efficiency, and the CO2 reductions are startling for two reasons. They're so large, but they also are the consequence of specific policy commitments made by the company some time ago. Why were the commitments so ambitious?
Thank you, Bill. DuPont started its focus on greenhouse gases in about 1990, and it really grew out of the science that the company came to understand because of the depletion of the ozone layer. DuPont was a primary manufacturer of CFCs and aggressively dealt with and participated in the policy discussion around the phase-out of CFCs and the bringing to the market of substitutes. As a part of that, we hired our own atmospheric scientists, and through his work and others, really came to understand the seriousness of the challenge and the problems caused by global warming. So it really started with a foundation in the science. And in 1990, the company embarked on a number of initiatives. One was to understand what its own greenhouse gas emissions were. And then we made a series of commitments to reduce those greenhouse gases. To date, we've reduced them 72%. A big part of that was a focus on energy. And we promised or committed to ourselves and to the public that we would hold our energy use flat with our 1990 levels, and we are now operating about 6% below 1990 levels, and we've grown the company about 30% since then. But it's really been through, I would say, a conscientious focus through all parts of the company that greenhouse gas emissions were serious, that we need to take very seriously our own contributions and get about reducing them.
I guess the question that raises, if the country's largest chemical company can do it, can others do it? Do you help them do it? Do you make products or advise on processes that that could turn into a business?
We have been asked by some companies to help them figure out how to reduce their energy use through some of the experiences that we have had. We are also we have focused a lot on our own footprint reduction, our own reduction of greenhouse gases, but more and more we see real growth opportunities with products that we can bring to the market to improve our customers' energy efficiency. So we absolutely are in that business in a number of different ways and really want to help people get their own energy use down.
Let me ask you a question about your research and development. You have made news recently with BP and others about commitments for the development of biofuels, also the development of plastics from plants through seed business. Is that a near-term kind of phenomenon? Can we look forward to new products that will significantly improve, particularly liquid fuels, in the near term? Or is that still in the research phase?
Both. We will be bringing biobutanol onto the market, we hope, sometime next year. But there's still more research to be done to make it truly cost-effective. We also, this fall, will be opening a plant in Tennessee that we will make PDO bio from plants. So it'll be a bio PDO. It will make a polymer that will then go into fibers for carpets or for fabrics. So we will have a corn feedstock that is producing polymers, and we're pretty excited about that. So, you know, we absolutely see in the near term products that we're going to be on the market that we're pretty excited about.
Tom, you were quoted earlier, and you've made some very bullish statements about the possibilities of reducing, I think, by 20% greenhouse gases from recycling energy. Could you elaborate on that? How would we do that? What is recycled energy anyway?
Sure, Bill. Thank you. Almost 40% of our CO2 in the U.S. comes from electricity, production of electricity. And it is only 33% efficient. It's only been 33% efficient for 45 years. There's been no improvement at all. With technology that we have, we could easily cut that number in half, and that would eliminate 20% of the greenhouse gas. And I think the folks here might think of that as a very real global warming problem, which I certainly do. But it's a very real economic problem. U.S. consumers are paying about $100 billion a year to the power companies to needlessly burn fuel so that we can put greenhouse gas up. Now, what do we do about it? You can recycle energy in two ways. First of all, you can go to industrial plants, and they burn energy, they make a good or a service, and then they throw a big waste stream away because it's not their business. To give you an example, my colleagues built four facilities in Indiana to take blast furnace gas that had been flared and waste heat from coke ovens. And those four facilities made about 5 billion kilowatt hours of electricity last year, of clean energy, electricity and heat, without any pollution, without any incremental fossil fuel. The steel company saved about $100 million. We put up all the investment, and we made money. That $100 million is 0.1% of what we could save in the U.S. if we did it all.
How do you encourage people to do it? How do you step up the commitment to it?
It's very difficult because we've set it up where the utilities own the wires and they want the throughput, and so they've enacted rules over 100 years that are just a tremendous headwind. And as we gradually get rid of some of those rules and enable these plants to capture some of the value they create, it's starting to happen, and we're beginning to see Wall Street put money in this area, and we just can't afford not to do it.
Thank you. General Clark, you're looking back at the war in Kuwait and then the war in Iraq. There have been some who've made the connection between national security and energy use, and yet neither of the administrations of those times there were some people who thought they should. There were two, I think, in the first Bush administration, including Brent Scowcroft. Should they have done something at that time with the urgency of the war to try to reduce our imports of energy, to try to improve our efficiency of energy use in the United States?
Well, absolutely. I think there are two national security problems here that we're dealing with, Bill. One is the energy dependence on imported fuels, and the other is the global warming issue. They're both national security problems, and you can't understand them without looking at the national security dimensions of them. But, you know, we got hit by the dependence on imported energy really in 1973 when Israel was at war and we had OPEC started raising prices and there was a cutoff on some nations shipping oil to the United States and so forth. And President Carter actually took a lot of initiatives in the energy area, including really pressing on the development of synfuel, burning coal to create a synthetic gas to be used in power generation, other things. And the market didn't pick up on those initiatives. Gradually, the government programs that encouraged the initiatives, money was taken out of them, laws were changed and allowed to fritter. So if you go across the United States, you find all kinds of remnants of earlier efforts. In California, where I was at the National Training Center, there was an effort to focus the sun on and heat oil called Solar One. Many of you have seen it driving from Los Angeles to Las Vegas. It shines brightly in the desert, and it was a good initiative at the time. Nobody has really built on it. The same thing with the synfuels. We could take the United States reserves of coal, which have far more energy than Saudi Arabia does, oil, and we could process this, generate a gas, and use it, and not be dependent on any imported fuels whatsoever for power generation. We could use it to develop, to create hydrogen. We can do a lot of things with this. But the bad news is the market it's not pure market economics. Energy prices are volatile. Investors are risk averse. These are long lead time projects, and they need government help.
Let me ask specifically to the military. The military runs on oil, I guess, except for aircraft carriers. It's not market constrained. Is it involved in the search for alternative fuels?
Well, not directly, but we're budget constrained. And so Congress gives us a mark, and then we suffer. So in my military career, I've been through three or four cycles of this. And I know that probably Senator Glenn has seen this too, but I was a battalion commander when we needed fuel for my tanks, and they said, no fuel's available. You can't have any fuel for the next 30 days for training.
It's good they didn't say it to Patton in World War II. Huh?
But this was, you know, well, they did. They did. And it's just you're dealing with a big organization's cost constraint. The military's done a lot over the years to try to improve the efficiency of its use of fuels. And, in fact, today the military is actually sponsoring a test of a B-52 bomber that will have two engines flown on syn fuel produced by taking natural gas and creating a synthetic kerosene out of it. So the military is doing its part, but this is really far beyond what the military can do.
Well, what should we do? What should the? Is there a leadership role? Is there a policy you would recommend?
Well, I think you've got to really have government leadership taking a look at the big picture. You really do have to have a comprehensive national energy policy that addresses not only energy independence but also global warming. In other words, you've got to decarbonize energy generation, and you've got to encourage efficiency by any number of means, and you've got to develop renewable sources of energy. It can't be done without a lot of government leadership.
How are we doing on time? That's how much we got left? Good. Yeah. Yeah, we started late, so I wasn't paying attention to it. At least to those out. But, well, let me ask some of the panel. The obvious inference from all of this is that we do have opportunities we're not exploiting. Are there ways that you see that a policy response could be developed that would encourage us to go further along the lines that some of your companies have already gone? Linda? Well, you have a little experience with national policy.
Clearly, the rising price of energy has made a lot of investments more cost-effective to undertake. So I think even within DuPont, the focus on more investment in energy efficiency is right in front of us. We're absolutely seeing much more enthusiasm around biofuels, and that's very much affected by the price of oil and the oil security issues. But I do think that we need a policy. We need a U.S. policy on global warming and on climate change to create the market pull for the energy efficient technologies that are out there, for the ones that aren't yet out there, but are within reach if we put the money and the resources into them. So I do think a formal climate change policy would help bring to market the new technologies that are going to be essential if we're going to solve this problem.
Jacques, is it part of Swiss Re's remit to try to influence public policy? Have you entered that realm and made your views known in a way that that governments have to listen?
Well, at a modest scale of one company, I think that in view of the overall financial impact, it is our duty to influence the stakeholders, and the stakeholders do include the political field. So yes, to contribute to the debate, to make our concerns known, to suggest solutions, to facilitate part of the discussions between interested parties is what we are trying to do by our various means. What we observe is that, we are great believers, of course, in market solutions. And what we observe is that, as mentioned a minute ago, there are more and more market trends which are helpful. And they don't have to be only related to the energy chain, but also to the way that people realize that they can truly improve their share of the wallet, frankly, to touch on their particular spending in terms of changing their habits. If you allow me a little anecdote, my two kids who are American born and American educated don't know how to switch off the light, and it's clear that on the other side of the pond it seems to be a perfectly normal thing to do. So that in small exercise at the margins make a difference in whatever industry, including the service industry, in our location, our headquarter location in Zurich. We have actually reduced the electricity consumptions per employee 10% during the last 2 years, just on 2 years, by very simple, small steps, which actually don't change anything to the normal efficiencies and way of working.
Tom, I'm going to ask you a question. I mentioned that industry has increased its energy use 10% over the last 30 years or so. Commercial side of things has increased its use of energy by more than 100%. Are you and your company able to respond to that growing use, profit use, a lot of people would say, with respect to the commercial side of things? And are you able to do it, if you talk about waste energy, Dave Hawkins is here, and I have to ask the question. When we last had a lot of significant proposals along those lines, we had some serious pollution consequences of the waste energy movement. Are you confident that they can be managed?
Absolutely. I'm not talking about municipal waste. We're taking things that are being burned anyway and just getting energy out of them. With respect to the whole commercial side, it makes no sense to generate power in a remote location. You put a small power plant next to the commercial and you take all the heat off of it and you get double use. And the problems are the rules that are standing there. This is the most subsidized commodity in the world, which cuts the value of what you save. We then tax people other ways for all the externalities that are caused, acid rain, global warming, whatever. We tax it rather than put it on the energy. So somebody that's trying to make a business out of efficiency is not getting anywhere close to the value that they're creating. Markets absolutely work.
Do you think the new California initiative will change that?
It is causing every developer in the country to think about setting shop up out there, because you're going to be able to capture maybe another $10 to $15 a megawatt because you saved some energy, and that makes the difference between a project and not a project. Yes, sir, it'll work.
Yeah. I have to say something, and I'd be interested in the panelists' views of it. My day job is I invest in water and renewable energy. And it would seem on the face of it as though high fossil fuel prices are likely to encourage development of alternatives, and that has been true, most particularly with regard to ethanol. But there's another consequence of those prices. It brings other fossil fuel development into the realm of possibility financially that weren't previously there, whether it's tar sands or various deep wells, or going back in and recovering product that hadn't been profitable before. Do you agree with that? I mean, what do we do about that? Is that a concern? Does that affect your business, for example?
For my business, there's a couple other trends going on. We've suddenly said to the electric utilities, you can't grandfather anymore, you've got to clean up. So electric prices are going up. That doesn't help bring more fossil fuel. That makes efficiency more interesting. Transmission we're running out of. It's costing a lot of money to build it. That raises electric. Clearly, as the fossil fuel prices go up, everybody in the market sees an opportunity to build their technology. And I think it's just getting up to a real level. And it'll bring forward the renewable energies and the efficiency, because we can do it cheaper than the fossil fuel if we get full value.
What about DuPont, Linda? Do the fossil fuel price increases in the sense that they will stay there, not maybe where they are, but some higher plateau than historically they've been at, does that cause DuPont to set more ambitious goals for energy efficiency?
Absolutely. I would say we have really stepped up our efforts internally around what are the additional opportunities we can get at energy efficiency. Things become more cost-effective to do as the price of oil goes up. We also have made a commitment to try to get 10% of our energy from renewable resources by the year 2010. We're about 5.5% right now.
I gather it's not that easy.
It is not that easy. We actually thought this goal would not be that difficult when we set it, and it's proved more challenging. But obviously, as the cost of oil goes up, more things become cost-effective in terms of renewable sources. The other thing, the rising cost or the volatility of the cost of natural gas is one of our primary feedstocks. And so what happens to the price of natural gas is very important to us.
Are you assuming that gas prices will stay where they are?
Well, there's been some softening. We like to see that. We are particularly concerned, I would say, as we look towards any kind of climate change program, that it be thought out more deeply than have all the coal burners switch to natural gas. Because as a feedstock user, we don't want to see it just go up as a source of energy. So that's really where we see some tension. You know, how we're going to, as a nation, approach greenhouse gas reductions is obviously very important to us.
I think we've about run out of time. I'm going to close with a question for you, General Clark. I was reminded as you were speaking, I once was in charge of a lot of jeeps and trucks when I was in the Army in Germany. And our instructions were that if the Russians came over very fast into Germany, we could put whatever fuel we had into those trucks. Jack Daniel's, Chanel No. 5, whatever we got. And they would make it to the French border, at least. Then you'd have to break them down and rebuild the engines. Are they still being manufactured so that they can use alternative fuels?
Those are the old trucks. We don't run on Jack Daniels anymore. No, we standardize all our fuel for JP8. And it's, you know, the Army's a big institution like any other. It's tried to be efficient. It's tried to march in step with national goals. But just like any other institution, we're also captive of legacy investments. So some of those trucks that you had, they may still be around.
So they'll still run on whatever we can put in them. All right. Thank you all very much. We have now some time to develop your questions.
That was great. Thank you very much. What we're going to ask the panelists to do now is they'll have about a half an hour together in another room to look at all the questions that you generated while they were talking. And they'll look at that and decide which of those they want to respond to. Meanwhile, you have a half an hour to actually talk at your tables. And there are two stimulating questions we want to give to you. And if your table gets beyond those questions, you can continue the conversation and put into the computers the other important ideas you come up with. But the two questions are, what actions can my company or organization take to cut energy waste? And you heard some examples of that from the panel already. And frankly, Bill asked the public policy question, too. The second question is, what incentives would help companies save more energy? So those are the two questions we hope you'll delve into as deeply as possible in 25 minutes. We started a little bit late, so we're going to shave this to 25. If there are some tables at the back where you have a smaller number of folks, we'd suggest that you collapse the tables so you actually have 8 or 9 people at every table. Enjoy, and we'll be back up front with the panelists in 25 minutes. You did a great job. There were literally hundreds of ideas coming into the theme team. All right, team. This is why most people don't let the audience talk. Okay. Got to wrap it up. Who can do the whistle? I never learned to do that. Okay, folks. Thanks very much. The theme team is finishing up your comments. If I could please ask you to drop your conversations. The panel, while you've been working, has been looking at your questions from earlier in the session, and they're now prepared to respond to your earlier questions. And in a few minutes, we'll hear the themes from your discussions. Bill.
Thank you. Well, we got some excellent questions raised by the conversations we've had, and I think I would start with one for you, Linda. We, as you know, certainly have had a lot of experience getting suppliers of companies, seeing suppliers of companies influenced by those who buy from them to reduce their hazardous waste or their other pollution-related activities. Do you do that? Do you try to influence suppliers and then, going beyond that, possibly customers?
We do try to work up and down the value chain.
Where we've really seen opportunity is working with the people that we supply to, with our customers, customers in the automobile industry, in the electronics industry, as they try to make their products more energy efficient or more fuel efficient. As a major materials supplier to those companies, we think we can bring a lot to the table to take, you know, pounds off automobiles, but keep them safe. By making the electronics work more efficiently with less energy. So we're finding, particularly as there's a lot of discussion around energy costs and more customers are the ultimate consumers are asking questions around energy efficiency, it is helping create a market for us to build better materials.
Tom, question for you here. To what extent will efficiency solutions rely on new technologies versus ones that already exist?
I think the new technologies is almost a smokescreen that chases us the wrong direction. There are many, many, many technologies that work today, and they're held back. If we were to invent a brand new one tomorrow, why wouldn't it be held back the same way? So I think our focus should totally be on changing the rules and the incentives so that we apply the technology we already have. Sure, new technology is great, but let's go get the low-hanging fruit. Let's ask why we're not deploying what's already working.
You know, that reminds me that we had an idea at EPA in the early 90s to encourage changes to lights that were energy efficient. And a little hard to believe that EPA at that time could have identified energy-saving solutions of a significant sort that companies themselves hadn't found. Kind of counterintuitive, but it turned out to be true. Are there opportunities like that now? That Energy Star computers was another one. Turn the computers off when you're not even building the technology to do that. Saves a lot of energy. It's a fast-growing area. What specifically could we look for in the way of commitments that might pick up on ideas that exploit existing technologies?
I think that if we understand what happens that we don't do the energy efficiency, is that most corporations restrict their capital to their core activities. And they either put no money or only a tiny little bit of money in non-core, and energy's non-core for all of them. What the Green Lights program did was it said to people, hey, this is good. You feel good about it. And so people start doing it. I think if we have government policies that clearly state that this is what we want to do, you'll have all kinds of corporations that instead of restricting energy efficiency to projects that have 3 to 5 month payback, which they literally do, you'll have them willing to invest in, let's say, 30% return projects. And just a little policy in that direction, and we'll finally get the headwind out of our face.
General, question here for you. Why promote conversion to syn fuels like coal when these still net carbon? Why not just promote renewables?
Well, it's a way of addressing the energy independence issue. You can take coal, American coal, you can create, for example, a synthetic diesel from it, and then you're not importing the petroleum to use it. You can get a very clean fuel out of that. There may be some environmental benefits also. And as the price of petroleum, crude oil rises, then these alternatives become economically feasible. I do think, though, that we need to really be pressing carbon sequestration on all of the efforts in this area and the other areas. In this scenario, carbon sequestration it's a great theory. Nobody's quite figured out how to do it practically. We're talking about using a lot of energy to do it and pumping it deep into the ground. A certain amount of the carbon dioxide is used by oil companies, but this is a tough problem. But I do think that we do need more leadership than just encouraging energy independence here. I think as we're working toward energy independence, we ought to also be working to address the national security implications of global warming.
I guess I've got another one here, Tom. I was going to ask you, how long until a company can expect an energy-saving technology to actually save money?
I can't completely answer the question because I've only been in the business since 75. And we've made money for our investors ever since then with applying energy-saving technologies, and it's back to that first question. There's plenty of technology. We just need to fix the rules and go apply it.
Are you able to make money by telling companies you'll save them money and you'd like a piece of the saving?
We sure are. We go to companies and say, give us your waste energy stream and a little bit of real estate. We'll put up our capital and our intellectual capital and give you the savings. And very often we end up with a two-year payback project in total, and ends up when we split the savings, the company gets two-thirds of it.
I'm happy to hear it. I have a story of a friend of mine consulted on energy, went to a distillery, told them he could save a huge amount of energy. They said, preposterous. He told them how, and they said, well, those were obvious. And they and they wouldn't pay him. So good luck. Well, let's turn to let's turn from industry for a moment. Is it profitable, Jacques? Is it profitable to cut carbon emissions? Do companies create a competitive advantage or disadvantage for themselves by doing so? You mentioned that investors increasingly are putting money into these kinds of activities and priorities. Obviously, it's not just public relations.
No, indeed. If we turn the table from the user to the investor, and also the human resource dimensions, I would have two type of remarks, which is that, as mentioned by Tom, actually most of the projects which are related to energy efficiencies turn out to be actually quite profitable. They have a good hurdle rate, and they are much faster in terms of their returns than what had been typically predicted. So from a strictly economic standpoint, it seems to work on average. The other side is probably most of the representative of public companies in this room have certainly noted the level of activism on the part of very large investor groups, in particular pension funds, with regards to the sustainability issue and thus what they are doing in terms of climate change, responsible emissions in general, I mean, the entire series of process. And frankly, in many instances, they either had to take note or they got under very serious pressures from a proxy standpoint or actually from a shares being sold and thus shareholder value being under threat. So clearly enough, it pays back from that perspective. The being responsible is the solution. In many instances recently, the banks themselves, in terms of their lending practice, have been put under huge pressure and must have agreed to specific adjustment to their lending policies to specifically take into consideration the type of energy efficiencies of the program that they support from a funding standpoint. So the loops are getting organized. And the last thing is that we certainly note from a service industry standpoint that the when recruiting young talents today, their level of sensitivity to the issue is very high. And if you built up a good reputation in that field, you are more likely than not to get actually the best talents rather than to have to fight it out in terms of what is your value proposition.
I think that last point particularly is a very interesting one. I can recall there was a time when Monsanto committed to reduce its hazardous waste beyond legal requirements by 90%, its emissions, and the first reaction of the chairman was to say, I hadn't realized so much high-value product was going out the stacks. They'd never done an economic analysis of that. But later that became somewhat costly when there was the recession in the early 90s, and they hired a couple of economists in Washington to analyze the reason, the rationale behind that, and whether they should keep with the policy. And they did their homework in economics. They finally said, well, why did you commit to it? And they said, well, frankly, we're a knowledge-intensive company, and we've bet the ranch on new inventions, on getting the very best chemists and scientists, and to which the answer was, well, you've answered your own question. If you're trying to recruit people to, in a knowledge-intensive industry, you want the best, and that is one way that you can help get them. Do you think that helps you hire at DuPont? Are these commitments things that the recruiters emphasize, and does that carry weight with potential hires?
It absolutely does, and I would also say, to our current employees, our commitment to sustainable growth is a very important thing. And, you know, old companies with legacies like DuPont, 200 years old, we do take our hits in the newspaper frequently. But the fact that we are committed to improving ourselves, very focused on reducing our own footprint, and committed to try to bring new, more sustainable products to the market is absolutely something that people care a lot about and get very enthused about. So it's not only a way we attract talent, it's equally a way we keep talent, and I think that's pretty important.
Let me ask a question with respect to investments either you, any of you here are making or are involved or aware of in some of the fastest growing economies, particularly in China, where we see something like 50,000 megawatts of new coal-fired power every year. Are you able to influence that? Is there a way in which those could be made cost-effective investments from the point of view of pollution controls, technologies that would be added to them? Do you have a sense of that? Tom?
I spend some of my time with the World Alliance for Decentralized Energy, and we have been able to persuade the Indian government that by giving a contract to local sugar mills to make power, they could avoid spending twice that much money building a central pole plant and then building the transmission and then losing 25% of the electricity on the way to the customer. And they've moved forward on the program and have called forth 2,000 megawatts of fuel-free energy just by changing this little bit of a policy, 87 sugar mills and a bunch of... So, yes, absolutely is possible. The conventional thinking that believes that the energy system is near optimal is the enemy, and it exists all over the world. So as we wean people off that conventional thinking, the wind will be at our back.
Shaq?
Well, I would start by suggesting that nobody can influence the Chinese. They have their mind, and they are very right too. But what I do notice is they certainly are extremely and intensely focused on the dangers and also the general macroeconomic efficiencies that they need to gain. The problem is not their new plants, which are actually made with the appropriate type of technology in most instances. It can be improved, but the problem is really mainly improving the rest, the old factories, whether energy production or actually all of the steel industries and the old cement industries, all the things which were extremely polluting from many standpoints. Their energy efficiencies today is approximately the worst in the world, competing with India on that, followed by the U.S. And at the other extreme, for $1 of GDP, Japan is using about one-third of the energy of the U.S. And, you know, I don't think that Japan is a place where it's uncomfortable and where the quality of life is disastrous. I mean, you can have personal judgment on that, but it seems to work pretty well. So it's the energy efficiency is on a scale which goes literally from 8 to 1, 1 being Japan, 8 being today China. They're very conscious that in the medium term, they need to get it done and fast to an efficiency level which would be more in line with Europe and Japan than actually even the U.S. So they have a strong motivation to do so. The second dimension goes back to the very first question that you had asked this afternoon, that, you know, Shanghai, their landmark financial center, has about 20% of the city, which is below the sea level. The notion of climate change and the consequences which can it have on water level is not something that they are ignoring entirely.
Are you insuring those buildings?
The tall one.
I'm reminded a former Secretary of State commented recently the Chinese must be forgiven for believing that they have somehow muddled through 4,000 years. He said 4,000 years of Chinese history without the benefit of advice of the United States. I won't identify who that was. David's going to talk to us about making some sense of this, the themes that are coming out of it.
Thank you, Bill. Let me just start by thanking the remarkable table facilitators. We just have an amazing group of volunteers who are working very hard, and they're doing an amazing job. So thanks to all of them. Incredibly talented. And then less visible to you, our theme team in the back, some of the smartest people on this issue in the world, and talk about drinking from a fire hose, if you can imagine all of this stuff coming back at them. So here is what they have just distilled from the conversation that you all had. First, on the question, what actions can my company take? We've got a lot of energy audit suggestions. Every company should be doing an energy audit day one. Second, design green buildings and focus on lighting. A lot of stuff about reducing travel and using video conferencing, use Skype. Some very interesting comments about procurement and purchasing and looking on the supply chain. And this is something we're going to be hearing from a number of companies about at this conference in terms of commitments. Very interesting suggestion to make energy use part of each employee's performance assessment. A lot of potential there. Overall, set goals and targets for the company, and then a lot of comments on raising awareness on the issue. And so that's a little stream from the fire hose on that question. On the question of incentives for saving energy, overwhelmingly, by far, the comment we got most was that we need mandatory measures from government, different shapes and sizes, but lots of views about needing mandatory measures, cap and trade programs, taxes where it's suggested. There was a real minority view that said, get government out of the way. The real problem here is we have too much government. But the overwhelming majority was that we need mandatory measures from government in order to really make this click quickly. Suggestions on fast-track permitting for green buildings, for creating tax and other incentives for clean cars and clean fuels, such as free parking for clean vehicles, and then getting industry associations to demand mandatory efficiency levels. My favorite quote that we got back there was this, and I'll close on it. Anyone in business not looking at their energy expenses now will be out of business a year from now. Thanks very much.
Well, let's get some reactions from the panel here. This last one, get industry associations to demand mandatory energy efficiency. I've been very impressed by watching the reactions to the CERES ratings when they produce reports that rank companies according to their achievement of CO2 reduction or sustainability goals. It gets attention in the boardroom, and people don't like to be too far down on that list. So whether demand mandatory, just simply best practices advertising and ranking, I think, makes some difference and has some effect. Is that something that that we would support? Do you think it matters to companies that you work with, Tom? I mean, a lot of people are not doing obvious things. If they get ranked low on a rating, would it get them to?
I think it absolutely would. This is a part of that whole education problem. We have most of the people thinking that it's going to cost money to lower energy, that we are absolutely perfectly optimal now. And so they don't want their trade association to go fight for better standards because it'll cost money. And it's an education problem because they have a big sign error where they think it's going to cost money, it's going to save money. And so my experience is that like the Steel Trade Association won't say boo about improving energy efficiency because they're afraid it's going to cost them more money. Hmm. They're wrong.
Make energy use part of each employee's performance assessment. I guess you could put the CEO up there, and that certainly gets attention from the CEO at least, especially if it's a compensation committee that sets it. Do you see that being done? Jacques, is that something that you think public companies are doing?
Well, then I couldn't say what all the public companies are doing. I think it is becoming a topic of attention in the appropriate fashion, not automatically in precise performance, but in terms of walking the talk. It's launching programs which are clearly giving incentive, monetary incentive, for the people to do the right thing. Mm-hmm. That's the other side. If you have a policeman approach, it's a negative connotation. If you have the positive wallet getting larger approach, I think it works better. It's definitely our positions. We just launched actually, thanks to the support of the Clinton Global Initiative, a program for all of our employees worldwide where we subsidize. At their choice, so it gets them the opportunity to choose an energy efficient decision on their part, from buying more energy efficient cars to actually having solar panels for their home, to making efficiencies in their home to using strictly public transport rather than their cars, whatever they choose to use it, they can pick and choose. And not applying it in one country, applying it worldwide. So then you walk the talk, you create the appropriate level of awareness, and I think that overall it hopefully will have an impact. It gets the people to think about it, and probably much beyond the investment that you actually are putting.
Linda?
I was just going to add, kind of combining these two, there is a role for both the recognition. At DuPont, we have saved, since 1990, about $3 billion because of our energy efficiency steps that we've taken, and that's serious money. So to many audiences, that's the most important thing. But the recognition, like the series recognition that we got, it helps a lot, too, because it tells the people who are working really hard on this stuff that they're being recognized for it. And it also becomes a third-party validator. And it's one thing for DuPont to stand up and say, we did this. It's another thing for somebody else to come along, do its own evaluation, and agree. And you know, people tend to trust a third party much more than they'll trust us. So there's a role for that. But if we weren't getting some of the savings we have, it would be hard to sustain the momentum inside.
One of the themes here is to set goals and targets. And in recent years, we've seen a tendency to produce reports, annual reports on the environmental performance of a company or on sustainability. I may just see the best of these. People send them to me because they're proud. I have the impression this is really growing, though, among at least public companies. Is that yours, too?
It's my sense that it is. More importantly, what people are measuring is expanding. I think when you were at EPA, they focused a lot just on their toxic release inventory. Now I think things like carbon, greenhouse gas releases, energy efficiency, they're broadening what they're measuring. And what everybody knows is what gets measured gets done. Mm-hmm. So I think that it is expanding. And as I said, more importantly, I think what's getting counted is growing too.
One of the recommendations here, reduce travel, use video conferencing, for example, Skype, et cetera. Practical? Is that? What do you think, General?
Well, absolutely. I mean, but you know, a lot of these are driven by cost. So, I mean, cost is your measure here of what you should be driving this by. And I think companies, especially the companies in the businesses I'm involved in the investment banking area, we're very, very cost conscious, especially on travel budgets, and we love Skype. Mm-hmm.
All right. One last question. Need mandatory measures from government. Anybody disagree with that on the panel? A comment?
I put the question another way. Should government pass standards to make buildings earthquake-proof, or should we just assume that the market will build them for the next earthquake?
All right. Thank you very much. Thanks, panel. Well, terrific conversation, excellent questions, and obviously a lively, informed, and involved audience. Terrific panel. Thank you, folks. Well done.
Ladies and gentlemen, to recognize commitments in energy and climate change, please welcome Secretary of Environment of the State of Pennsylvania, the Honorable Kathleen McGinty.
Well, hello, everyone. It's very good to see all of you. Let's start by thanking the one person who always thanks everyone else, but who is the real reason we're gathered, and that's our fearless leader, David Sandilow. Where is he? I get to do all of the terrific fun work now in recognizing the terrific real work that all of you have been doing. So let's welcome our first recipient of recognition and a certificate today, Barry Appleton with the Appleton Foundation. And I'm very happy as a proud driver and owner of a hybrid, especially to recognize Barry and to welcome him. Here he comes. Hello, Barry. Now, specifically, Barry is going to, in partnership with the Hittery Foundation and smarttransportation.org, is creating Green Apple, a new charitable program to facilitate the conversion of taxis and public transportation to hybrid and low-emission vehicles across Canada. Very good. Barry's commitment is to the tune of $1 million Canadian over 3 years. And as I present this certificate to him, I want to point out two particularly important aspects of what he's going to do. Linda Fisher just said, what gets measured gets done. Barry, in his initiative, is keeping names, taking track, and keeping numbers. So he is going to be looking after those he is supporting. And second, Barry's initiative is testimony to the staying power of this conference and the Clinton Global Initiative. Barry, I think it is correct to say you were inspired by the Hittery Foundation and one of last year's commitments. So we're growing and many good things happening. And let's start with Barry. Many of you, like me, spent 45 minutes today driving 10 blocks. We're recognizing Fred for two new initiatives. One is peak pricing, so that folks coming into New York at high drive times will face a new price that they would pay for that experience. But also, I think, testimony to Fred's terrific both vision and pragmatism. We're also recognizing Fred Krupp in environmental defense for a terrific investment and initiative to bring a carbon neutrality to coal-fired power plants. The vision, carbon neutral future, but the practicality is we have to start dealing with the technology that's there that we have to deal with today. So to Fred, again, terrific leadership and initiative on both counts. It's great to see you, buddy.
Thank you.
Oh, the photo. We'll do it back there. Okay. Oh, you are back there. So the photo is happening. Okay, thank you. We'd like to recognize third, Matt Peterson, who's the CEO of Global Green. And I also have to confess, Matt, as you're coming up, Matt, who's done brilliant work in terms of green buildings in California, through this initiative is taking that leadership to Louisiana, to New Orleans in particular, to ensure that all of the new schools that will be built there will be green buildings. The reason why I'm particularly happy to do this is because Pennsylvania is second only to California in the number of green buildings that we have. So I'm glad you're taking your energy to Louisiana. Let's congratulate Matt Peterson. I also want to now welcome up Wendy Abrams and her partner, who is John Waldenberg. And Wendy Abrams, I also want to give personal tribute to the Clinton Global Initiative, because Wendy and I became great email buddies, both of us in coal states, and conspiring through email as to how we were going to green those coal states. So Wendy has done a terrific job in Illinois, and today we commend her and John Waldenberg for their Cool Globes initiative. For any of you who have seen the Cows on Parade initiatives that many cities and localities have taken, what Wendy and John are doing is taking that same idea to the climate challenge, and through a series of public art exhibits, they will present globes, each of which will present a solution, a part of the puzzle to solve, to take on in a serious way, the climate challenge. And I think that is terrific vision, and terrific initiative. I'm sure it's going to be quite successful. So let's thank Wendy and John.